Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. The author Robert Heinlein famously said, a human being should be able to change a diaper, plan an invasion, butcher a hog, con a ship, design a building, write a sonnet, balance accounts, build a wall, set a bone, comfort the dying, take orders, give orders, cooperate, act alone, solve equations, analyze a new problem, pitch manure, program a computer, cook a tasty meal, fight efficiently, die gallantly. Specialization is for insects. Compelling as that sounds, why do so many of us fall short of that kind of ideal and cease to learn new and different skills in our adulthood? My guest today would say it's because we approach learning the wrong way. His name is Robert Twigger, and he's the author of Micromastery: Learn Small, Learn Fast, and Unlock Your Potential to Achieve Anything. Today on the show, Robert makes the case that we often fail to learn new things because we feel we have to learn the whole field of a subject, which is overwhelming, tedious, and demotivating. A better approach, he says, is to first master just one distinct skill that's part of said subject, or what he calls a micromastery. We discuss what micromasteries are, why they keep you motivated to continue learning that field, and in general, the benefits of lifelong learning, and why specialization is indeed for insects. We also discuss what the punk rock scene of decades ago could teach you about tackling new skills, and we end our conversation with Robert's use of omelet making as a case study in micromastery. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/micromastery. Robert joins me now via clearcast.io. Robert Twigger, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you've written a book called Micromastery: Learn Small, Learn Fast, and Unlock Your Potential to Achieve Anything. So what is a micromastery?
A micromastery, well, I've defined it as a self-contained unit of doing. So it's something that's complete in itself, but it's connected to the greater field. So that's sort of the abstract version of it, but what it is, it's kind of like the distilled essence of an activity. So if I give you a few examples, say
sure.
When I started the whole process, I thought about becoming a good cook, and that seemed like a daunting task. But then I thought, okay, I knew that as a test piece for your ability as a cook, making a perfect omelet was often used. If you went for a job as a chef, they'd ask you to make a perfect omelet. So that's the kind of the first micromastery that I stumbled upon, because an omelet has in it, making it, all the skills that you need, or almost all the skills that you need for far more complicated kinds of cooking. And so it's that ability to sort of boil something down, and something that's repeatable. So an omelet only takes a minute or 2 minutes to make. So you can make an awful lot of them, so you can get better, which is important because you need to repeat in order to practice something, and it needs some kind of payoff. You know, a micromastery is something that needs some kind of payoff. So, you know, people, you know, it's kind of like the hey wow thing. You've done a trick, or you've done something that's pretty cool. If you can do a 360 on a skateboard, people go, oh, that's good, and you feel a bit better about yourself. And I think people underestimate how much feedback we need when we start learning something. I know when I started doing Aikido, the Japanese martial art, people would say, well, what can you do? And at the beginning, I couldn't really do anything. So it didn't feel like I was learning much.
Well, let's talk about the benefits of approaching learning with this micromastery idea, as opposed to the way most people go about learning. So like, what's the way that most people go about learning a skill? And why do you think this micromastery concept is better?
Well, if you think back to how you've probably approached things, I certainly know I have. It's been very haphazard. I often sort of get an idea in my head, oh, yeah, it'd be great to learn Arabic, for example. But I sort of buying a textbook, I don't really go much beyond that. You know, maybe I would look up courses. I've got a very conventional approach, and it's all tinged with boredom. I would say that for me, the notion of learning, having been through the school system, it's always got this sort of tinge of boredom about it. And so micromastery was head on, wanted to get rid of that sort of essential boring element that is in learning, and it doesn't have to really be there. So that was the starting point. So once I had worked out that you could really find these micromasteries everywhere, I looked for things which definitely have a fun element, and there is something kind of essentially fun about the way they do it.
What I like about the MicroMastery approach is that instead of initially going wide in a field, trying to learn everything about it all at once, you first take a small step and then you go upstream. And that circumvents a lot of what keeps us from sticking with something where it's too daunting, it's too tedious, and you just give up. Instead, you're having these satisfying little successes that sustain your momentum. Let's talk about some of the more, stick into the elements of a mic, what makes a skill a micro mastery skill. So you talk about it's like a self-contained unit. So like, instead of thinking I'm going to become a better cook, I'm going to learn how to cook an omelet would be example. Instead of I'm going to become a, learn how to play baseball, it's like, well, I'm going to learn how to throw the ball, like a fastball correctly. Yeah. So these are skills that are self-contained. They're repeatable, but let's dig in even further. Like, you even, there's like, I think a six part, it's like six elements you've laid out of what, like the components of a micro mastery skill. What are those?
Well, what I realized is that the all micro masters have what I call it the entry trick. It's some piece of information that once you're in possession of it, it immediately levels you up. And what I discovered is that experts often jealously guard this information and you find it out much later when you don't really even need it. I mean, I found that a lot of artists in the past, including some of the sort of the great masters of the Renaissance, used tracings when they did crowd scenes. They didn't muck around, you know, arranging a whole load of models and do it from life. They used to swap each other's tracings. So some of the crowd scenes look slightly similar. It's an entry trick, you know. It's something that immediately levels you up. If you know that an artist sometimes uses a tracing to get one step ahead, why not use it yourself? And I knew in writing that writers use a lot of simple tricks that tend to be not known about, and they certainly don't teach them at school. And so, I mean, the entry trick for, let's say, surfing is get yourself a foam board, you know, a board that isn't going to hurt you when you fall off it and it hits you on the back of the head. Practice jumping up on top of it, on top of your bed. You know, immediately that's going to give you, because it's, you know, bed is slightly wobbly, it will give you an advantage over someone who's trying to learn to surf in, you know, choppy water. So these are little information, bits of information that can immediately cause you to level up. So, and you find those usually by asking experts. They're the sort of shortcuts that they use, the little tricks that they know about. And the next thing is that as I said, you need to have some payoff, something when you've done the micro mastery, when you've surfed that wave, or stood up on your surfboard, when you've cooked that omelet, people give you some feedback. So you don't want something that's just essentially lonesome and, you know, doesn't have any kind of end point. And the nature of micro mastery is it's small, so it's repeatable. So that's the other element, which leads into it being gameable. By which I mean you can change the elements, and this is how you really start learning. It's not really about mindless repetition. Learning is about tweaking it, changing it, recalibrating. So with the omelets, you know, do you use one egg, two egg? How hot is the pan? How far away from the heat do you hold it? Do you use oil? Do you use butter? You know, there are lots of little things that you can alter and make it gameable or experimental. It's taking an experimental approach to something that is very much broadly the same, but you can change all these elements.
And so what's helpful about the entry level trick is that it feels really gratifying to learn, and that gives you a boost to keep going. Another element you talk about, and I think it's kind of connected to the entry trick, is this idea, you call it the rub pat barrier, or like the counterintuitive skill.
Yeah, the rub pat barrier is the point in every skill that's worth having that's slightly, looks slightly difficult at first, has this point where there are two sort of sub skills push against each other. So, I mean, if you're driving a stick shift car, there comes a point if you're learning to drive when it actually interferes with your steering, because you've got to think about moving your hand down, moving the gear lever, and then going back to steering. And you have to coordinate these two skills. And I call it the rub pat barrier because it's rather like patting your stomach and rubbing your head, or rubbing your stomach and patting your head. These are, to coordinate those two things at once seems problematic, but you learn how to do it. And so you identify before you even start, where's the point going to be in this skill where there are two elements that pull against each other? And that's usually when people give up, because they kind of think, oh, this is too hard. But if you already know that's going to happen in advance. You can focus your energies on it.
And you can use like that a trick basically to get over that barrier.
There are often tricks that you can use to get over that barrier. So for example, in the example of a kayak roll, you're going to have to coordinate the hip movement that you're making with the arm movement with the paddle to sort of flip the boat back up. But if you understand that you can transmit, you're going to transmit that hip movement through your knees and your legs, you've actually got a kind of an advantage over somebody who really isn't quite sure what they're supposed to be doing.
And you give, one of the examples you give in the book that has a rub pat barrier that I'm familiar with is you talk about the bench press is a skill.
Yeah.
And the counterintuitive thing there is you think when you bench press, all you're doing is just going up. You're just pressing the bar up.
Yeah.
But really, if you want to make the lift more efficient, you have to press up and back.
Yeah.
And like going backwards is very counterintuitive for people.
That's true. I mean, the bench press is a brilliant micromastery because at first it does look really like just a really simple thing, but actually there's a lot of skill and coordination involved. So, it's a very satisfying one because obviously you can boast to people how many pounds you're lifting.
Right. No. And I've been, lifting weights for several years now and I'm still messing with it because like I'm still getting over that rub pat barrier of pushing the bar back because you just want to, your body just wants to go up.
Yeah.
But you need to press it back. The one that gets really, what's similar to that is the shoulder press.
Yeah.
Where you're standing and you're just pressing it up. Like you have to press the thing backwards. Like you have to like pretend like you're going to throw the bar back behind you. And you don't want to do that because you feel like, well, if I do that, like I'm going to lose control. But as soon as you do, the bar just goes up so much easier.
That's a tip. That's worth listening to this podcast alone for that one.
Right. But see that, but like that's like, because what you're doing when you do that is you're keeping the bar over your center of gravity.
Exactly. Yes. Because that's why machines are actually not very, as you know, machines are just an inferior way of exercising because you're conforming yourself to the demands of the machine rather than, you know, the most efficient way to lift that weight.
Well, and let's talk about this payoff thing, because I think that's an important thing you hit throughout the book, and you've already talked about it. When you were writing about it, it made me think when I was a kid and I got into magic.
Yeah.
And the thing that like helped, make become magic like an obsession for me is I learned that one really easy trick and I was able to impress my parents. And they're like, oh, that's really cool. And that made me want to do it more. And, what worked for you as a kid, that's still an effect today. People want to feel, get recognition for acquiring new skills.
It's true. Because often that's the reason why people sign up for courses and go along to organized learning environments, because they're going to get that kind of attention from the teacher, and the teacher will give them a pat on the back, and probably the other students will if they achieve better than the average grade. But it's much easier to just find things and identify the payoff without having to go through the rigmarole of doing a course in it. So the magic trick's perfect for that because, of course, it's all about that payoff. And in the book, I talk about the three card trick, which is a very simple con game, but also it works as a magic trick. And you can show that to people and learn that quite quickly.
And it's something you can do. When you say, I know a magic trick, or I'm studying magic, people are always going to ask, what can you do?
Show me. They're not going to say, and you tell them, oh, well, I haven't learned any tricks yet.
They're not going to say, explain to me the theory of magic and the psychology
yeah,
of it.
No, exactly.
Show me something. So you argue that there's micro masteries in everything, cooking, weightlifting.
You can usually find them.
Yeah. So how do you find them?
Well, I set myself the challenge of, in the book, actually, of saying, subjects I had no interest in were lawn care and international law. And I thought, okay, now where's the challenge? Where's the micromastery? And so I what you do to find it, you have to find where's the fun in the subject for you? Where's the exciting element for you? And then you kind of break it down. So for me, I thought about, when I was a kid, people had these, in the UK, cricket pitches that need to be rolled really flat. And often as a punishment, all the boys were given this task of rolling it flat, but it wasn't really a punishment. We really enjoyed doing it because it's a really heavy machine, this roller thing. So I thought, okay, then that would be the micromastery would be to start around getting your lawn really flat and rolling. And so it sort of starts from there. So look for where the fun in something is and then kind of build out from there. And usually that's where you can identify where it is. Other ways are just simply ask an expert in that field. So, for example, in carpentry, I asked this guy who's a top cabinet maker I know, and he said, make a perfect cube of wood. Because it's actually a really difficult thing to do, because as soon as you cut one bits off one side, it's not a perfect cube anymore. And the skills you use to make a perfect cube of wood are all the skills that you need for being a good carpenter.
Well, let's talk about, you know, it's talking to experts, because that can lead you astray, because oftentimes experts, their knowledge is tacit. Like they just know it, and they have a hard time explaining it because they have the curse of knowledge. So, I mean,
that's true. And so sometimes you have to approach it a bit sideways. And, but if you explain, what I found is I explained the micromastery concept to an expert, they usually dig one out. So I was explaining one to a sculptor, and he said, make a skull out of clay. Don't try and sculpt a head, just make a skull, and then try and make a funny skull or a sad skull. And so he'd identified a micromastery for sculpture. So if you have an expert at your disposal, you can usually explain the micromastery idea, and they will dig into their knowledge and find one for you. But you're absolutely right. There is the tacit element of, you know, this, they don't really know what they're doing, but, well, they're not very good at explaining it. And you can see that if you go online for something like omelet making. There are certain, you know, Gordon Ramsay making an omelet is not very, first of all, he breaks the omelet as well. It's not a great omelet. You have to poke around to find the right people. So I think of it as like a network of things. It's not just experts. It's, you read about it, you look for hints online. You have to be a bit of a researcher, and you know, things that catch your eye, or going back into, you know, things you thought were cool as a kid. Often that can be a very good starting point.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. And now back to the show. Okay, so learning a micromastery skill can be a way into exploring a wider field, but they're also complete in themselves. They're a pleasure in themselves, so that it can be the only skill you learn in that field. Even then, though, they motivate you to keep learning skills in other fields. But why should people even take this continual learning approach in life? Like, why learn a bunch of different disparate skills that aren't connected? Like, well, why learn how to do the kayak roll or throw fastball or to do the perfect bench press? And what's the purpose of that?
Humans are learning machines, and we are happy learning. Even though school is trying to just beat that out of us, it is actually something we're meant to do. And lots of things are actually disguised learning experiences. So, you know, when you go to a new city and you're walking around, you're actually learning all the time about what that city is like. So, I mean, things like confidence. What is a confident person? A confident person is someone who isn't scared to have a go, but they know they're not scared to have a go because they know they can learn it. They have confidence in their learning ability. A lot of people who are not confident simply think they can't learn things, and they keep sticking to what they know, or the limited amount of things they know. So, and there's definitely true that the more you learn, the better you become at it. And the more learning tactics you have, the better you become at it. So there is a kind of, you know, there's a functional reason for learning stuff, which is that the better you are at learning, the better you are at living. But also it's good to give yourself permission to be interested in anything. I think we live in a world where we're bombarded by so much information. For the first time in history, we're in a world where information is actually kind of toxic. We're turning it off. You know, we're saying no rather than yes. And I don't think that's a natural human response. Human response is to see something interesting and want to find out about it. That's, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, you know, interesting things meant food. They meant something important. And we should naturally kind of follow that kind of way of being, I think. And so a micromastery is a way to be satisfy the desire to be interested in. You can say yes to something, but you don't have to devote your entire life to it. It was about permission to be interested in everything, which I think is normal. And it's what you like when you're a kid. But when you're an adult, you say, oh, no, I haven't got time for that. No, I can't buy that book. Oh, I can't do that. And that's kind of a depressing way of living, I think.
Right. Or you're told, well, you got to specialize in something and make that your thing.
Yeah, you know, and that becomes, it becomes boring. Specializing sounds great because, of course, it gives you an economic advantage. And it comes from from the business world, really, but it's migrated into the human world to our detriment. I mean, every job that is completely specialized is basically boring. And the most interesting jobs that people want, things like being a film director or an explorer, jobs that are actually polymathic, they have loads of different elements.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you look back, you know, maybe even 100 years ago, 150, like if you were a farmer, like you had to know a whole bunch of different things to do your job.
That's true. And I think that it is, it's not a great thing. You know, more and more jobs are actually sitting, as we are now, staring at a computer screen. And that's not a great way to spend your time, you know, if it's the bulk of your time. So it's, you have to do something extra. And I think that MicroMastery maybe supplies that kind of extra element. I mean, if you have to earn a living, so be it, but at least have other elements there.
Yeah. I was thinking about my favorite job. I mean, I enjoy my job now, but one of my favorite jobs I had when I was right out of high school was I worked at the paint shop at the medical school. And we don't not only painted, and I learned how to paint. Like, there's a MicroMastery there, like how to paint an edge, right? Like, that's a skill. But then we also, like, so one day I'd be like laying tile, so I learned how to do the mortar, right, the glue or whatever. And there's a skill there. And that whole job, that whole summer, I just acquired all these little MicroMasteries, and you'd learn it, and then you'd do the project for, you know, maybe 2 or 3 days, and then it was on to something else. And I learned how to, trying to think of the other things. Yeah, it's carpet. I learned how to lay carpet, cut carpet,
yeah,
which was amazing.
Using your knees to kick it
right
in, did you?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, I mean, it was a lot of fun. It was just because I was always learning something, like a new discrete skill that I can still bust out today. Like, I can still paint an awesome edge, an awesome corner.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that that never leaves you. That's the other thing about MicroMastery. It can't be taken away from you. And that's a really good feeling that you've got these skills. And I think it's sad that school doesn't really do that so much. And, you know, you can come out of school having spent, you know, 5 years studying French, and you can probably only say a few things. You know, it's kind of lamentable, really.
So if you're in a job that's very specialized, learning these varied skills can be something you do in your spare time. Pursuing these skills, besides being satisfying, besides being a confidence booster and helping you become more competent and better at life, but also it's good for your brain to constantly learn new things. As you said, like, learning new things is normal for human beings. And once we stop learning new things, like, our brain actually deteriorates.
Yeah. I mean, evidence of cognitive decay is increasing in adults because, I mean, and this is research. I quote some of the leading experts into stroke recovery because, I mean, stroke, how people recover from a stroke is measurable, and it shows the ability of the brain to continually grow even in old age. A lot of people grew up with the notion that the brain was, you know, an erroneous notion that the brain had a sort of set number of cells. And, you know, once you'd learned your basic stuff, it didn't really grow anymore. We now know the brain is constantly adapting. The plastic brain is the new model, and you have to keep learning. It's learn it or lose it. And so that in itself is an incentive. And often when I talk about MicroMastery and the audience is a bit older, this is the time when they suddenly start paying attention, because just doing the crossword puzzle isn't really enough. There's a lot of evidence. You actually have to learn stuff as you get older. And you have to, if you don't learn it, the neurotransmitters associated with learning are gradually decrease. And so you actually become unable to learn anything. I mean, I watched a TV program where they had this elderly, he was a football team manager, and he was having to learn French, and he just couldn't hold it in his head. He'd obviously hadn't done any learning. He was good at managing a football team, but he hadn't done any learning for 40 years. He just couldn't do it. So, but the good news is, starting small, doing a little bit every day, you build up that neurotransmitter, you build up the ability to learn. So that is a definite health benefit.
So yeah, there's a case for just, you know, dabbling in different things and not feeling bad. Because I think that's another thing. People are afraid to be a dabbler because, you know, then you're like, you're a dilettante. It's like, well, you can't stick with anything. But the MicroMastery concept's like, well, I don't have to stick with it. I learned this discrete skill.
Yeah.
And that's all I need. And if that's all I want to learn, that's okay.
That's it. And you've got something that you can you know, it's a bit like a party piece. It's kind of complete in itself. It doesn't really need you to do any more. You know, the fact that you can, you know, get on the surfboard, stand up on that surfboard and surf a wave, that's enough. You don't have to then devote your entire life to it, or even a greater part of your life.
Yeah. Like, I can stack a great stack of wood. That's all. That's a discrete skill. That's awesome.
Very useful.
Very useful. Flipping a pancake, I think, is a micro mastery.
Totally. That sorts out the men from the boys, definitely. The people who go for it, and the others who kind of mess it up and it ends up on the taps or on the stove or something.
Yeah. You have in here, like, splitting a log is another one.
Which
there's a skill to it. There's a trick. And once you learn the trick, or even like, splitting a log, like, when was the thing there is you want to let the maul do all the work. Oftentimes people want to just swing as hard as they can. That's not the trick.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're right. And if you see people who, like, native people, often women, chopping wood, the axe or the machete does all the work. They're just letting it drop, really. But the other one I love, because I put this in the book, it's a skill that's actually gone because everyone has chainsaws, but the actual chopping a log in half rather than splitting it. And if you watch, and often in movies they get this wrong, they just sort of, like, viciously go at a kind of V in the log. And of course, eventually you have to start chopping at each side to widen the V. Whereas the correct way is you make two cuts that are the width of the log apart, and then you kind of angle the axe so that chip just flies out. You actually get rid of a big lump of wood, and it's miles faster. And that is the traditional and correct way of chopping a log. So that's a kind of skill that really impresses people.
It does impress people. You had the section about how the punk rock scene, like in the 70s and 80s, can teach us something about micro mastery. So I was, like, in the 90s, I was like a punk rocker. Like, what the punk, like, as punk rock you could be in, like, suburban Oklahoma, which is probably not very punk rock. But there is an ethos there that I think does apply to this micro mastery concept.
Definitely. It's the have a go ethos. You know, basically in the 70s, you know, the music had become really bloated and you had these huge super groups. And then suddenly a whole bunch of guys in garages said, oh, well, we can't even play instruments, but we want to be pop stars. And so they would construct them with the simplest kind of songs. And even I read the other day, Sid Vicious, the reason he started his pogo dancing is he couldn't dance. So he just, in frustration, just started jumping up and down and invented a new dance. So it's that willingness to have a go. And punk rockers, you know, they did their own recording. They often set up their own record companies. They had their own fanzines. They were willing to have a go at everything, and it took over and created a whole movement in music that eventually the conventional record companies got on board with. And an interesting modern day example is I don't know if you have this bit craft beer in America, but in the UK it's huge. It's called BrewDog. And the founder of BrewDog actually wrote a book calling his book a punk businessman, because he'd grown up with punk rock, and that idea of doing everything, in his case, brewing the beer in his garage when he started, doing the marketing, going out to get the money from the bank, bottling it, all of these things he was willing to have a go at. He wasn't trying to outsource it to specialists, and that gave him a much bigger control and a much bigger ability to do it cheaply. Because I mean, the moment you start asking experts to do things for you, you're just going to be writing checks left, right, and center.
Right. No, that was one thing that I enjoyed about the punk rock scene was, you know, if you wanted to do a show, well, you just, like, you rented out an American Legion hall and you made your own crappy flyers at Kinko's.
Yeah.
You handed them out, and then you made your own cassette tapes that, you know, didn't sound great, but, like, you just did it. Like, you weren't afraid to put it out there. You just, as you said, give it a go. And I like that a lot.
Why did you give up in the end?
I think I just outgrew it. Like, I mean, I was never, like, in a punk band. I just went to the shows and listened. I think I outgrew. I mean, I still carry that ethos with me. I'm just like, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to give it a go. But I mean, what's crazy too is I think things are a lot easier now to give it a go.
But you're right. It is actually never been easier to do a lot of these things.
And you have like YouTube videos that could show you how to do things. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you didn't have that 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, it was really difficult. I fixed my car the other day, replacing some broken tail lights. I would never have done that in the past because it did involve removing a couple of bumper panels in the right order. But the video, 6-minute video on YouTube, ordered the parts on eBay for, minimal sum, saved myself probably $200 or $300. So it's fantastic in a way.
So yeah, I think the idea there, we start talking about punk rockers. It's like, just don't be afraid to give it a try and just go for it. And you might mess up a lot in the beginning. It might be terrible, but if you find that micro mastery skill in that thing you want to learn, because it's repeatable, because it's self-contained, you can easily master it.
It's a painless way of approaching something. And I think that I've mentioned this before, we now go through life with these kind of our mindset to know. Like when you're walking down a crowded street, you're basically not open, because if you were, panhandlers or, people might get in your way or whatever. So you're more or less saying no to life. But of course, that isn't the normal human response. Normally we're supposed to be open and interested in things. So this is a way of getting around that kind of no barrier that we've had to erect around ourselves to get through life.
So we've been talking about micro masteries in the abstract, why they're great, why you should develop them and the benefits of it. But can you walk us through like a micro mastery that you've enjoyed that can give us a taste of what we're talking about here?
The first one, which I've spoken about several times, which is the omelet making, is I think it's satisfying because it's such an easy thing to do. And the entry trick, which I picked up from a French cook, was if you want to immediately make the omelets fluffier, which will get a response, and this isn't the classical way to make an omelet, but it is a way to immediately get that payback, is to separate out the egg white and the egg yolk and beat that white a lot and then recombine them later, you will get a much, much fluffier omelet. So immediately you've got this entry trick skill and the acknowledgement that when you're making an omelet, in the past, I would just sort of put them straight into the pan. I didn't realize that the whole kind of rub pat barrier, if you like, in making omelets is to do with the heat of the heat of the pan and how much you kind of agitate the omelet mix. Because in fact, an omelet is actually closer to scrambled eggs than people think. They think it's more like a pancake, but it really, if you've got the model of kind of scrambled eggs in your mind, that's kind of closer. So the simple way around that barrier is, don't mess around with the gas control on the oven. Just lift the pan up and down, and learn how to control the heat in the pan by just the distance it is from the flames. So it's another very, very simple kind of trick that enables you to get around that problem of the correct heat of what the pan should be. And there are all sorts of, like the classical way to make an omelet is to use a fork, which at first seems like, people are, use spatulas and so on, but a fork is a really good piece of equipment for cooking an omelet, because you can keep agitating the mix in the pan, and that builds it up and makes it much fluffier. And then when it comes to tipping it out, you can use the fork to gradually roll up the omelet, because in the classical omelet you roll it up when you dump it out. And another entry trick, which isn't so widely known, is that it's almost impossible to undercook an omelet, but it's very, very, and this is why, because it's a test piece, it's very, very easy to overcook one and just make it like rubber. So once you know that, it's always much better to err on the side of undercooking. And because once you've rolled that omelet up, it will keep cooking. So you don't really need to worry. So, with that information, you should be able to cook some pretty, pretty good omelets.
Right. But you said that, like, even though you've got those entry tricks down, like you're still tweaking with it, like you're still experimenting with it. Like it's not, it doesn't stop. It can stop there if you want, but it doesn't necessarily have to.
It doesn't because you're kind of interested in the process and you want to improve, and you, you want to experiment. I think that's a sort of natural human thing to want to do.
And this is all what I think this micromastery concept does is you're learning how to learn again, which is becoming a skill that is essential in today's world where, you know, skills are constantly upgrading and changing. So like what you were able to do to get ahead in life or make a living, you know, is might not be relevant 10, 15 years from now. So you have to know how to learn. And this micromastery concept is a way to learn how to learn.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, no, it's absolutely true. I mean, in my own career, I earned money as a journalist and, you know, pretty good money as freelance journalist. That's pretty much dried up. Obviously, there are a few magazines and newspapers that are still going, but vast amounts of that revenue now goes to Facebook. So, you know, the people who are journalists have got to learn something new. And if you're not prepared to learn something new, well, you're not going to earn a living.
Right. Well, Robert, where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
So, yeah, I mean, the book's on Amazon. In fact, most of my books are on Amazon, so you can get them there or from Barnes & Noble, those websites. And I also have a website, which is a blog, and it has a lot of articles. It probably has nearly 1,000 articles on it, and that's roberttwigger.com. So that's covers a whole range of subjects, but yeah, you can dig around in there, and there's more on micromastery. There's more on some of the traveling I've done and various other things I've been involved in.
Well, fantastic, Robert Twigger. Thanks for your time. I'm gonna go make an omelet now.
Cheers. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. My guest today was Robert Twigger. He's the author of the book Micromastery. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find out more information about his work at his website, Robert Twigger. It's Twigger with two G's.com. Also check out our show notes at aom.is/micromastery, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Check out our podcast archives at artofmanliness.com. There's over 500 episodes there. And while you're there, check out our platform called The Strenuous Life. It's an online platform that we created to help you put into action the things we've been talking about on the podcast. And one thing we do there in the Art of Manliness, help you develop different skill sets. It kind of ties in nicely with this micromastery podcast. So if that intrigues you, you want to put into action, check out The Strenuous Life. We've created 50 different badges based around 50 different skills, where we create little micromasteries to help keep you motivated to learn more about that field. So check it out, strenuouslife.co. We got an enrollment coming up in September. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the Art of Manliness podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Go to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use promo code manliness to get a month free. And once you're signed up, download the Stitcher Premium app or download the Stitcher app on iOS or Android, and you can start enjoying the Art of Manliness podcast ad-free. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who think we get something out of it. Send them a text, shoot them an email, bring it up a conversation. We'd really appreciate it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only listen to the AON podcast, but put what you've heard into action.